is a really historic win for Senator Murkowski. She got this is a very audacious win for her.
Congress looks ready to approve the Sea Alaska land selections in the Tongass National Forest. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers start talking about regulating marijuana.
The idea that the legislature would come in and try to subvert the public will, in my opinion, is off the table.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at Alaska.bp.com.
Sea Alaska Corporation would get land within the Tongass National Forest for logging in a bill that's moving quickly in the final days of Congress. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the long-awaited Sea Alaska bill is one piece of a public lands package that's been added to a must-pass defense bill.
The bill would turn over about 70,000 acres of the Tongass National Forest to Sea Alaska, mostly for logging and development. Sea Alaska has been pressing Congress for such a bill for years to complete its land selections under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Jaylene Arujo, Sea Alaska General Counsel, is pleased but cautious.
Well, we haven't had activity on our bill since they both passed through the committees of the House and the Senate. They've been waiting for well over a year, probably a year and a half, since we've had any action on them. So for us, we're just happy to have some movement.
Nationally, the bill moves 110,000 acres out of national control, enables a controversial copper mine in Arizona, and expands a BLM program to streamline drilling permits. Outside of Alaska, it also establishes more than 200,000 acres of wilderness and designates new national parks. Senator Lisa Murkowski says it's the culmination of weeks of negotiations. Leaders of both parties in the House and Senate have approved the deal. If it passes, it will be the most extensive public lands legislation to become law in years. Murkowski spokesman Robert Dillon says the package has widespread support in Congress because it includes a variety of measures that appeal to different lawmakers.
This is, you know, it's a large, comprehensive package, but it really strikes a good balance between, you know, conservation. There's wilderness bills in here, there's new parks, and economic opportunity and development.
The collection of land bills came together just this week, but Dillon says all of the elements have been thoroughly discussed in public.
Sea Alaska especially, I mean, Sea Alaska had 7 years of public process.
Dillon says the bill will serve as a bridge as Southeast Alaska lessens its reliance on old-growth harvest.
The Sea Alaska bill will help keep the timber industry alive while the Forest Service moves over to a second-growth strategy. It will give the timber mills in Alaska enough timber for the future to get through.
The Sea Alaska transfer divides environmental groups. While the bill conveys 70,000 acres on Prince of Wales and other islands, it also conserves more than 150,000 acres of the Tongass for salmon habitat and wildlife. The Alaska Wilderness League sees that as significant. But Ethan Manuel, who has been fighting the Sea Alaska bill for years on behalf of the Sierra Club, says it's little consolation.
Even though the bill did get a little bit better, the fact that it privatizes part of the Tongass National Forest is a deal breaker for the Sierra Club.
Manuel, though, says he sees no chance of stopping the bill now.
This is a really historic win for Senator Murkowski. She got this is a very odd. So the fact that Sea Alaska is going to be allowed to operate outside of the boundaries of ANSCA is a pretty good plume in their hat.
The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act promised acreage to Alaska Native corporations, and Senator Murkowski says her bill fulfills that commitment to the shareholders of Sea Alaska. In what could be taken as a sign of its balance, the bill is opposed by both the Sierra Club and the Competitive Enterprise Institute, which complains it would lock up federal land in western states. The House is expected to pass the bill tomorrow, and then it moves to the Senate. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
With the initiative to treat marijuana like alcohol now certified, lawmakers are preparing for the issue to come up this legislative session. Senator Liesl McGuire, an Anchorage Republican who will chair the Senate Judiciary Committee, commissioned a legislative report examining the costs and logistics of marijuana law implementation. It lays out what authority the legislature has when regulating the drug and includes an estimate that the state will net between $0 and $3 million from marijuana commercialization in the first year. As regulation costs go down and the marijuana industry matures, sales of the drug is expected to bring in more than $20 million in annual tax revenue by 2020. When it comes to marijuana legislation, McGuire says the number one goal for her is to implement the voters' will.
The idea that the legislature would come in and try to subvert the public will, in my opinion, is off the table.
The marijuana initiative stipulates that the legislature can create a body like the Alcohol Beverage Control Board to regulate the sale of the drug. If the legislature does nothing, the alcohol board could end up responsible for marijuana. McGuire plans to file a bill that would allow the substances to be managed separately.
ABC 1 is overburdened as it is. They have a lot of issues that they're already taking on as a board. And number two, because there is a perceived conflict of interest.
McGuire says the marijuana and beverage industries could end up competing, which would make it harder for them to be regulated by the same group. McGuire, who voted for the initiative, says her bill may regulate marijuana advertising and drug safety issues. She also plans to look at the interplay between state and federal law.
I think this is going to be the most challenging issue that we'll face. It's still illegal under federal law to consume marijuana. So what happens when someone who lives in rural Alaska is transporting that marijuana via their boat?
In the House, Anchorage Republican Bob Lynn has already announced he plans to file a bill preventing marijuana retailers from operating near schools, churches, and parks. McGuire says multiple marijuana bills are likely to be combined into one omnibus bill. The marijuana initiative was modeled after similar ballot measures in Washington and Colorado, where it passed with 53% of the vote. Municipal leaders in the Fairbanks area gathered for a meeting last night with about 120 citizens to talk about the state's marijuana legalization law. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, the first of its kind meeting was held so the leaders could talk amongst themselves and with the audience about how they're going to put the law into practice.
Fairbanks North Star Borough Assemblyman Carl Castle says he organized the extraordinary meeting with elected leaders of the borough and its two cities because each jurisdiction will have to make its own decisions on how it's going to deal with the pot legalization law.
It's a very complicated issue. It involves our entire community, and I think it behooves us to see if we can get all three local governments on the same page to the greatest extent possible.
Assistant Borough Attorney Wendy Doxey explained the law and then fielded numerous questions from the 15 or so elected leaders in front of the lively crowd at the Pioneer Park Civic Center. Doxey concedes she couldn't answer many of the questions dealing with how the municipalities are going to handle businesses that sell marijuana and pot products because the law is unclear.
There's a lot of clarification that's needed. There's a lot of gaps in the act as it stands right now.
Doxey says legislators are going to have to sort out most of those details in the next session.
Whether they do that by statute and legislation or they leave it to the regulations to flesh things out, but something I think has to happen, yes.
Castle and several other of the elected leaders thought something has to happen soon at the local level, at least discussions and planning, because personal use of pot will be legal by the end of February, and commercial pot production and sales could begin by the end of next year or early 2016. Several of the municipal leaders clearly opposed pot legalization and especially sales in their jurisdictions, but Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins says he believes his jurisdiction should move ahead on the issue and not put it on hold or ban pot sales, as some Anchorage municipal leaders seem inclined to do.
I don't see a moratorium action coming forward, not by me, and I don't think that's the right move. I know that Anchorage Assembly is looking at some of these actions, and I don't think we need to be following the big sister city in the south.
Fairbanks Mayor John Eberhardt's chief of staff, Jim Williams, says his boss feels pretty much the same way. North Pole Mayor Bryce Ward, who represents the only area that voted against ballot measure 2, didn't offer an opinion on whether that city would regulate or ban pot sales. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Supporters of a proposed ballot initiative aimed at public corruption have been given the okay to begin gathering signatures. The measure would make it a felony for public officials to legislate competitive advantages for or direct appropriations to themselves, business associates, family members, employers, or past, present, or sought-after campaign contributors. Contributors would include donors to third-party groups backing the election of those officials. Those benefiting from violations they induced would also face a felony. Before leaving office, Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell certified the initiative application, giving supporters a year to gather more than 28,000 signatures. Their goal is to get it on the 2016 ballot. A primary sponsor of the measure, former legislator Ray Metcalf, says members of government should make decisions based on merit, not on who contributes to their campaigns. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the art and science of traditional gut sewing, including selecting the right animal.
I asked my husband or my brother, one of my brothers, to bring home a walrus gut. I never do that again.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Rescuers have recovered the bodies of 11 more crew members from a South Korean Pollock boat that sank in the Bering Sea on Monday. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports.
The U.S. Coast Guard has been helping Russian officials and Good Samaritan fishing vessels look for survivors from the Oryang 501 since Monday. The trawler was hit by a wave and sank in Russian waters northwest of St. Matthew Island. 7 crew members were rescued from a life raft and one more died. More than 40 are still missing, and Coast Guard Petty Officer Grant DeVoist says they have no plans to stop searching.
We don't know exactly how prepared the crew members who are still missing were when they went to the water, so that plays a huge role in how long someone would have been able to survive on the water. So we're going to continue searching, continue working with the Russians and the Good Samaritans.
The weather on scene has been growing calmer, with seas around 5 feet and visibility up to 5 miles on Wednesday. DeVoist says they haven't been able to spot much debris from the sunk vessel.
So far, what our air assets have been able to locate are a couple black life rafts that were floating, and that's the only wreckage they've reported.
He says the Coast Guard has sent the cutters Monroe and Alex Haley, plus aircraft from Air Station Kodiak, to help as the search goes on. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
The University of Alaska system has delayed a campus climate survey originally scheduled for October. The goal of the survey is to gauge the prevalence of sexual assault on campus and students' attitudes on the issue. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
After initial delays this fall, the University of Alaska didn't want the survey to bump against the holidays and final exams. University attorney Michael O'Brien says a survey about sexual assault on campus may bring about unexpected emotions.
During stressful times of year, we have an extra duty to be concerned about our students' mental health and putting them in a situation that could trigger past experiences with sexual harassment or particular sexual assault was a bad idea.
This is the first time University of Alaska will do a campus climate survey. Back in April, the White House provided sample questions and recommended that colleges around the country conduct surveys. Initially, the university modeled its survey after the federal government's. O'Brien says the questions were focused primarily on sexual violence.
And obviously, we want to know about that. But we also want to know about cyberbullying, online harassment, and it doesn't really talk about that. So because our goal is to get it right, we want to focus on, is there either a better product or something we can add to this to make it the most comprehensive for our community?
University of Alaska also heard complaints from other schools that the White House survey was unclear, too narrow, and didn't address the needs of certain student populations. In May, the U.S. Department of Education put University of Alaska on a list of about 80 colleges nationwide being investigated for mishandling sexual assault complaints or as part of a compliance review. Federal auditors from the Office of Civil Rights visited campuses in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Bethel in October. A monthly online newsletter for UA employees called the Statewide Voice says the survey will likely be conducted early next year. Around 18,000 students, faculty, and staff will be randomly selected to participate. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
It was a relatively quick season for Southeast Alaska sea cucumber divers. The season closed in mid-November after the fleet landed a little more than 1 million pounds of the seafood delicacy. Meanwhile, it looks like diving for gooey duck clams may not be over so quickly. KFSK's Joe Vicnicki reports.
By mid-November, divers had reached or nearly reached guideline harvest levels in all 17 different areas of the region that were open for fishing. The largest hauls this year came out of Mora Sound and Doll Island near Prince of Wales Island, along with Ernest Sound closer to Wrangell and in Peril Strait near Sitka. Phil Doherty is executive director of the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association, a Ketchikan-based industry group.
I didn't hear any problems out on the grounds. Our quota was just a little over 1 million pounds, which is down quite a bit from some of the levels we've seen in the past few years. So the season lasted approximately 6 or 7 weeks, which is a fast season.
With larger guideline harvest levels in the past, the season has typically remained open past Thanksgiving and into December. Doherty expects the price to wind up somewhere around $4 to $4.50 a pound this year. That's in line with the price from the last few years and would put the value of the fishery around $4 million at the docks. To compare, last year's harvest hit 1.5 million pounds, and at nearly $4 a pound, it was worth over $6 million at the docks. Number of divers participating has stayed just below 200 for the past decade, and divers have earned an average around $30,000 in the past 2 years. Meanwhile, another dive fishery that also opened this fall won't be over quite as quickly. Around half the 750,000-pound guideline harvest level for gooey duck clams has been harvested, but Doherty says divers will be slowing down their harvest in the colder months. Divers have decided to cut the length of Thursday openings from 6 hours to 3 hours. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Juneau's nonprofit homeless shelter, the Glory Hole, will be closed at least a month after a burst water pipe caused major flood damage last weekend. Patrons and staff were adjusting to that new reality on Tuesday. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Mike Ricker was about to go to sleep Sunday when the water started pouring down on top of him.
It came down through the sheetrock in the ceilings, three floors, because it was in the ceiling of the third floor, and down through the light fixtures. The lights were on, and the water was just pouring down out of them.
Even though it's technically an emergency shelter, Ricker has lived at the Glory Hole for about a year. He says he ended up homeless after getting behind on a number of bills. Now he's working odd jobs and trying to get his life back on track. Ricker and about 20 other Glory Hole patrons are housed at Juneau International Hostel for the time being. St. Anne's Parish Hall downtown is hosting the shelter's regular breakfast, lunch, and dinner service. Ricker says he's grateful to the hostel and church for stepping up on short notice.
If they weren't open, then what option would we have? You know, we'd be in a pretty tough situation. Thank God for them.
Glory Hole cook Katie Parrott says the whole situation is stressful for both staff and clients.
We just want to make sure that people know that we're still serving food and handing out sack lunches. So, you know, we're still operating to the best of our ability.
Parrott served about 10 people lunch on Tuesday, a smaller crowd than normal. She says the breakfast service for 21 patrons was about average.
So it could be just, you know, a lot of people will be doing things throughout the day. Maybe won't be here for lunch, but will be here for dinner. It could be that people are trying to find somewhere to store their things. Who knows?
The closure of the shelter comes after the first big snowstorm of winter hit Juneau over the weekend. Glory Hole Executive Director Maria Lovishuk says the broken pipe had frozen before it sprung the leak. Lovishuk says insurance will cover the cost of repairs, but she worries people will forget about the shelter while it's closed during the holidays, a time when the Glory Hole typically receives a lot of donations.
One of the concerns that I have is that, our fundraising efforts this year will not be as great. And so, you know, our operating funds for next year will be jeopardized.
She says contractor North Pacific Erectors is already working on getting the shelter back in business, and the public can help by continuing to donate money and food. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The Anchorage Museum is hosting three Alaska Native artists this week. They are teaching students and others about gut sewing, a traditional skill still used today to make rain gear. They're also learning about the craft from each other and from historical items in the museum's collection. KSKA's Ann Hillman spoke with the artists.
Yupik elder Mary Tunichuk picks up the beginnings of a raincoat made of dried bearded seal intestine and shows a group of elementary school students.
So this is the back of the hood. And this is the arm.
The semi-translucent material crinkles like paper every time Tunichuk touches it. She says the guts are extremely delicate when dry. You have to dip the parka in seawater to make it more flexible before putting it on. She says the traditional gear provides the best protection from rain and cold, especially when hunting on the ocean.
The snow is blowing. The seas are rough. And you're getting cold. If you have a rubber raincoat, you're going to freeze to death. But if you have this one, this gut parka, you're going to last a little bit longer because it's going to keep you warm.
She says the guts are more breathable than modern materials, and they don't freeze and crack. Tunichuk started sewing guts about 50 years ago. She says her husband needed a parka, and as a young wife, she had to make one for him. To make a parka, women start with fresh intestines from seals or walrus. They scrape off the flesh and the fat from the 70-foot-long guts and rinse them for hours. Then they blow up the cleaned intestines like a balloon and wait for them to dry. Tunichuk says she prefers working with bearded seals over walrus.
One time I asked my husband or my brother, one of my brothers, to bring home a walrus gut. I never do that again. It's so wide and everything seems like it just like super glued in there.
Once the guts are dry, she carefully sews them together using sinu and sometimes seagrass.
But don't use a sewing machine or an electrical thing because their stitches are so close together that when you try to pull it out, you might tear it apart.
Tunichuk says sewing a parka can take many days. Every village has different patterns and stitches for sewing. She's learned even more styles by looking at the materials in the collection at the Anchorage Museum. Aaron Kroll is the director of the Smithsonian Arctic Studies Center, which is housed at the museum. He says the goal of the residency is for the artists to learn from each other and from the artifacts, and they're teaching the museum staff about caring for the materials.
They're also talking about the processing and the material qualities of
intestine and other membranes from inside sea mammals, and how those are uniquely suited to Arctic clothing.
The artists will be at the museum for the rest of the week. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Attracting an audience of more than 10,000 Facebook followers, a Tuksuk Bay teenager is creating his own version of Yupik songs and sharing them with an international audience. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
16-year-old Byron Nikolai curated a Facebook page called I Sing You Dance that recently became very popular in and out of the country after his songs were featured on TV news.
They helped me reach up to 10,000 because before KTUU it was only 3,000 and after that to 7,000, then to 10,000. It's crazy for a guy like me in a village to get that many likes.
Nikolai has been a drummer in Tuksuk Bay's traditional group since fifth grade. He says his video page started when he downloaded an app and started playing around with it. After he uploaded videos without distortion, his audience told him they prefer his natural voice. This song describes Alaska Native culture and is one of his most popular videos with almost 3,000 likes. He hasn't stopped experimenting with his sound. Many of Nikolai's fans said this song was their favorite, even though most of them don't speak the language. His voice is augmented by a natural echo off a drum, a trick he learned from his cousin, Moses Charles.
One time during a rock practice, he showed me how he did that, and I thought it sounded awesome. The phone has to be inside of the circle of the drum for you to hear the echo. That's why I'm kind of so close.
Nikolai says his songs aren't exactly traditional, though a Tuksuk Bay elder, Joseph Anaruk Felix, who sings with Byron in school, is glad to hear the young man making music projects.
When I listened to the videos, the singing seemed unique to his style and personality, but I like it very much. They don't have dances attached to them, as is our tradition, but it is very entertaining to me. I encourage other people to try this because it brings us closer to our culture.
Nikolai says he is working on a song that goes with a dance and expects to release it sometime soon. He says he would like to be able to travel to teach about his culture and traditional dancing. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, Lisa Fu and Casey Kelly in Juneau, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Charles Enoch in Bethel. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine.
Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.